Friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and irishradio.com worldwide. Delighted to welcome a friend, not only a friend of ours, but I would say he is, without a doubt, among the most novelists, political historian, a chronicler of New York City. He's an author of several books. Before I get into any more about this amazing guest of today, I'd like to welcome Peter Quinn. How are you, Peter?
I'm good, Adrian. How are you?
Good.
I think the first time I was on your show was 25 years ago, so we were both a little younger then.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I want to ask you, though, a little bit about your own background, your grandparents, your parents, before we get to you.
Yeah, my mother's parents were from Cork, from Macroom and Blarney. And my father's father was from Tipperary, but his mother was from the Bronx. But she was born on April 18th, 1863, in the village of Fordham before there was a Bronx.
My God.
So my roots in the Bronx go way back. I was raised in the East Bronx in Parkchester. And I went to Catholic grammar school, St. Raymond's, Catholic high school, Manhattan Prep, Catholic college, Manhattan College, and graduate school at Fordham. So I was never outside a Bronx Catholic course classroom, which might account for some of what I am. So that's, I lived in the Bronx all my youth and through college. And I feel really deep roots in there. And my wife is from Valentine Avenue in the Bronx. She was from the West Bronx. I was from the East Bronx. So we said we have a mixed marriage.
Yes. And actually, that brings us to your wife, Kathy. And Hot Dog Beach. Now, let's start there. Both of you happened to meet there, or?
1968. I was working as a doorman on 72nd Street, and we went to Richie Havens' concert, and then spontaneously decided to go out to the Hamptons. A friend of mine had a car, and we went out, and we were patrolling the beach to try to find people to crash with. And my brother noticed these two very attractive girls that he knew from the Neck Inn in the Bronx, and he went over to talk to them, and standing next to them was the sister of one of the girls, and I looked at her, and I was just dumb, and I still am. That was 54 years ago.
Oh, my God.
We've been married 40 years. We went out for 14 years. I said in the west of Ireland, that's what they used to call a whirlwind courtship.
Absolutely. Starting with your... among the first books, we had Banished Children of Eve, Looking for Jimmy, In Search of Irish America, and then you had a trilogy of historical detective novels, Hour of the Cat,
right.
The Man Who Never Returned, and Dry Bones. But let me ask you about, it has been perceived indeed that you've been retired for quite some time. Back, what was it, 2007?
Other 2008, yeah. I retired from Time Warner.
From Time Warner. And, by that time, you had it made. What was, did you happen to retire knowing that there were several books in you that you better sit down and write? Or were you born writer anyway?
I've always felt that way. I wrote Banished Children of Eve because I was a speechwriter for Hugh Carey and Mario Cuomo. And I realized at some point that nobody's ever going to know I for other people. So that was part of my impetus to write a novel. I wanted to put my name on something that belonged just to me. And I also have this feeling about New York City history that I love my own family, and I approached it through a novel. So it took me 10 years to do Banished Children of Eve, and now it took 9 months to do Quest Bug. So I'm making progress. I hope by the time I die, I'm able to write books in 5 days.
The implication is that a few more books may be there somewhere. Have you cleared this with your wife, Kathy? Or is she very happy just to leave you alone? You know.
Well, you know, when I wrote the books, when I was working at Time Warner, I got up at 5:30. I had a full-time job. I couldn't just go and write, and two children to put through school. So I'd write for 2 hours in the morning, do my own work, reading, and then turn to the day job. And, you know, that was oppressive in some ways and very taxing, but in other ways it was good because I had to compress everything. I couldn't just sit all day and toy with a book. I had this certain amount of time. I would either do it then or not do it. And that was a great discipline I learned of writing, because the basic skill of writing is sitting.
Yeah.
You have to learn to sit for hours, and you have to learn to deal with the frustration and just plow ahead. You know, I used to, at Time Warner, people used to say to me, I'm going to do what you do when I retire. I said, oh, that's nice. You're going to go up to the attic and drive a nail through your head every day?
Yeah. It's, again, discipline being the operative word, it does right. take a huge amount of commitment. And as we all know, I don't know that because I don't have it, never did, never will.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, though, about speech writing for two very prominent New York governors, both
right.
Democrats. And,
right.
Yes, writing speeches, obviously, is a unique talent. Now, very few can actually do it. But what is the atmosphere when you're writing a speech? And particularly if there's a deadline or you know, or a news breaking story, and
right.
you don't have a chance, I assume, to sit down with the governor
right.
and say let's sue. So what's that process like?
It's a process of fear and total panic, knowing that you're under this pressure and that people are waiting for what you're going to produce. I remember when I was first writing for Kerry, I had never written a speech. This offer to write speeches came out of the blue. And I wrote the Fordham Law School commencement speech and the John Jay commencement speech, you know, by the seat of my pants. And then they offered me a job, and I was down at 1350 Avenue of the Americas in the governor's
mm-hmm.
office. And I said, you know, I don't belong here. I got to get out of here. And I looked out, and there was a state trooper there. So I better get the speech or they're going to get arrested. So it was that, just the sheer necessity that I had to, I didn't have a choice. I had to produce it. So that was a great, you know, people say they wait for the muse to write. Well, I didn't wait for the muse. The discipline was I either produced the speech or I wouldn't have a job. And he would either like the speech, and if he didn't like enough of them, I would also be looking for a job. So there was a kind of brute simplicity to what I did. And it was a great way to learn how to write, I think, on a lot of levels. And, you know,
yeah.
I told myself I was in graduate school at Fordham. I completed all the qualifications for a PhD except the thesis. And I got this offer. I said, I'll go for a year and make some money and come back and finish the PhD. Well, I did speech writing for 30 years and never went back.
Yeah. Well, you did okay, obviously. What about the... again, you touched on it briefly there, but what about the speech writing where either of the governors said, geez, what was that about? I didn't know that, or I wouldn't have said that, or something. Were they few and far between?
Yes, they were both very intelligent, highly articulate men, and they were never at a loss for words. You know, the speeches are all different kinds of speeches. Like, some are 5 pages and or short, which can be very difficult. And then there was a speech at Notre Dame that Cuomo gave, which was really exhaustive and really hard to write. It took several weeks back and forth. So there was no one speech. They're all over the place. What I used to hate to hear is make it funny, because there's nothing harder than writing comedy, as far as I'm concerned. It's so easy to bomb. But, you know, the thing about speech writing is there's always a deadline. You're never away from a deadline. You can never tell the boss, oh, I need another week, or give me 2 more days. It's just that simple.
Yeah, yeah. Can we go to a very famous speech of historic proportions? Let's take the speech, the National Democratic Convention, Cuomo's speech, which is to this day, and that's Mario Cuomo, by the way. This was a speech which really grasped the attention of writers, yes, of just about everybody, but writers, your style, as told, as read by Governor Mario Cuomo, is one, you know, that history will not let die. What about that one, and preparing for that one?
Well, you know, I tell the story in the book. It's a long story of Cuomo was not just somebody you hand a speech to. We worked on it. We worked on it together. I wouldn't say I wrote it and handed it to him. We went back and forth for maybe a week. We, at one point towards the end, we took people from the mailroom and other people. We were in the 2 World Trade Center, and we brought them into the press room and turned out the lights, and he read the speech. So these were, you know, ordinary people. And they said, we said, what do you think? They said, it stinks. So we went back to the governor's office, Tim Russert, myself, Andrew Cuomo, and it was Tim Russert who had an idea. There was this section of the speech where he addresses the president. He said, put that in the front. So we did. Then we came back, and we got another group of people, and they said, oh, it's great, except for the ending. It stinks. So I went, and I looked through the governor's diaries, and I found this thing about his father working so hard, he bled from the bottom of his feet. And I made that the ending, and then we did it a third time, and people loved it. Yeah. So that's what he took to San Francisco. Well, the other thing about Cuomo was, Cuomo had a really strong physical presence. He was very thick. He had the hands of a baseball player. And he made that speech his own. He, you know, somebody else maybe wouldn't have done the same with that speech. But it was, you know, that line from Yeats about telling the dancer from the dance?
Yeah.
Well, it was telling the speech from Cuomo. He was the speech.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was an exciting thing to watch, you know, and it was happening. You never knew. Which is the other thing about speeches. You can write a speech you think is really good, and then the audience doesn't think it's good. And part of the what speech works is the relationship of the audience to the speaker. If there's electricity there, it'll work. If there isn't, it just falls flat.
You know, just to tell us a little bit about growing up, though, in Parkchester, And it wasn't all an Irish neighborhood. It was Jewish and Irish primarily.
Right.
Yeah.
And Italian. We kind of lived with Jews and went to schools with Italians at St. Raymond's.
Yeah.
And it was metropolitan life. Didn't rent to African Americans, which we didn't even think about in those days. It was not on our agenda, but in retrospect, there were 12,000 apartments, and the thought that African Americans were routinely excluded is kind of horrifying at this point. But it was, you know, at the time, again, I wasn't aware of that as a kid. It was just, you know, Irish, Italian, Jewish. Yeah. I tell a story in the book about, you know, we lived with Jews. There were 3 Jewish families on my floor. It was all very cordial, but I didn't have a Jewish friend. But I used to take the 20 bus to Manhattan Prep, and I got on the bus, and there was this beautiful Jewish girl who was like a hippie before there were hippies. and I had an insane crush on her, but I never had the ability to say anything to her. And one day she was gone. I guess she went to college, and I was bereft for about 6 months for my Jewish girlfriend who didn't know I loved her. But that's how the divides were. You didn't date outside your... My mother's first question of any girl I dated was, what parish is she from?
Oh, my God, yeah. And in fact, you know, there are many who say that it is a strong point of Irish-Americans, narrowbacks, to identify from whence they came, not by the region or even the borough or whatever, by the parish, and that's it.
Right.
I mean, and
you could tell a lot, you know. You could tell a lot by what parish somebody was from. There were, like, wealthy parishes, not wealthy parishes.
Yeah.
My wife, St. Angela Marici's down 161st Street. I was from St. Raymond's.
Yeah.
It was interesting. St. Raymond's and St. Helena.
Yeah.
And this is kind of insane, but we didn't mix that much.
Yeah. Was there a sense of competition, particularly in the Catholic schools, the parishes? Was there rivalry? Was there just ignored wherever others came from?
There wasn't really rivalry, you know. Well, some parishes, St. Helena's had great dances, Friday night dances, and mm-hmm. Palatine had great Saturday night dances. So, you know, there was that social mingling, and, you know, you wouldn't think of not going out with somebody because the parish they're from. It wasn't like dating a Protestant. That would have been horrified.
Yeah.
my mother would have been aghast. So, but both my kids have married Protestants, so the world is changing.
Absolutely. And there are the color barriers from Parchester.
Right. Right.
Were you around for that, or did that happen after you had left Parchester? You know, was that considered to be like upper middle class, let's keep it the way it is?
Yeah. Well, you know, it wasn't, people used to think of it as upper middle class, but it was very intentionally designed by Metropolitan Life as middle class. They had income goals that people couldn't make over a certain amount or less than a certain amount. But Parkchester people had a reputation of being uppity. And I remember I was in a Vista volunteer out in Kansas City, and I met another guy. He was from the Bronx. And he said, you know, people in Parkchester didn't think that your feces stunk, to put it politely. And I said, well, actually, we did have very good toilets. And it was, you know, it was, that's what Metropolitan Life designed it for, to as a middle-class community. And Metropolitan Life, the people who ran it, were overtly racist. They built a little project in Harlem, Riverton, for blacks.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the size. You know, Parkchester and Stuyvesant Town were both built by Metropolitan Life, and they're very similar in the way they look in the apartments. And at the time, they were... you know, people, middle-class people were really desperate for housing, and they were really desirable apartments.
Mm. You know, when you entered the corporate field again with Time Warner, how different was that in terms of speech writing? Had you shut down the political aspects of your previous speech writing and developed a new approach when it came to the corporate?
Well, one of the nice things about the corporate world was it paid three times as much as the government, which was. But Time Inc., the chairman of Time Inc., you spoke about a lot of social issues because that he was head of the largest magazine company in the world. So I worked for a wonderful man, Dick Monroe, who was the CEO, and he spoke about education and disarmament. So I wasn't just limited to business speeches, but I knew nothing about business. And I had to learn by the seat of my pants. Unfortunately, I had some really good mentors who took me aside. They would have these things called EBITDA, earnings before. I hadn't a clue what they were talking about. So I had to sit down with financial – I had to write financial speeches. So I had to sit down with the financial people and say, you got to explain this to me in a way that I can explain it to other people, because if you can't explain it to me, I can't explain it to anybody else. So just make it simple. Let's reduce this to something that's – comprehensible instead of like business jargon.
Yeah.
So, and, You know, I went through three mergers. Mergers are like civil wars.
Oh, boy.
So, one thing is, you know, I was writing these detective novels and I never saw any crimes, but I did see a lot of how people act under pressure. And that helped me write. You know, I was writing from personal experience of human interaction. And, you know, there was, a lot of times it was like a cauldron of mergers with people worried about who's going to fire whom and who's getting ahead of whom and who's, you know. The AOL merger was a classic, the worst merger in American history.
Right, yeah. And did you, what was the pressure like? Or was it better or worse than speech writing for, you know, two successive governors in New York? What was that?
It was, you know, they're different worlds. I was never, the thing was the governor speaking all the time.
Right.
You know, maybe twice a week, and the issues change, and we used to read, the front section of the B section of the Times was the local politics, state and city, which doesn't exist anymore. So we used to read that the next day, like the sporting pages. See who got what, and, you know, it was really moment by moment, day by day, and the corporate world was much more relaxed.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Time Warner merger was very harrowing, and there would be periods like that where you would be totally inundated and you'd be working all the time, but there would also be the down periods, and one of the best parts of working at Time Warner, the corporate retreats. We went to some really luxurious resorts, supposedly to brainstorm about the next, actually to play golf, swim, have delicious dinners, and then come home and tell my wife how hard I worked.
But by the time it came to, now you had a chief speech writer, and again under the, you know, the pressures of mergers et al., you decided to pack it in 2007.
Yeah.
And did you feel that that was it? Were you fed up with it? Were you burned out? Or what?
I just turned 60 in 2007, I just said, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't have anything more to give or say, and I'm just tired of it. And people told me if you stay to 65, everything will increase, your pension,
sure.
All this stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. Well, I might be dead in 5 years. I'd rather have the time, and, you know, I have enough money to survive to the end of my life, so what am I going to stay here and work still?
Yeah.
You know, one of the ironies of my speech writing career was my father was in politics. He is with an assemblyman and a congressman. And as a kid, I told myself, I don't want anything to do with politics. And then I wind up speech writer in Albany, where he served for 8 years in the assembly.
Yeah.
So, you know, life takes some strange twists.
Yeah.
But I never had a life. I never had a life plan. So. You know, I was incredibly lucky. I was lucky to get the writing job with the governor. I was lucky to be able to publish books. I was lucky that I found the woman I did. So, you know, you call it luck or grace, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, or both. But
yeah, right.
I want to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, could you bring us to, again, now it's 2007, now you're retired. Did you take a break from writing, or were you just, you know, a divot for punishment and couldn't stop?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, in essence, I think of myself as a writer. So Bill Kennedy once said to me, the defining element of writers is they write. So I kept writing, but I was no longer under the pressure that I had been. And, you know, there's Boyle's law that gases expand to the volume of what they're in. So instead of having 2 hours in the morning, I had all day. I have an office upstairs. I'd wander up there, have a cup of coffee, read the Times, and write. So, you know, it was much more relaxed. I really enjoyed retirement. I'm very grateful for the time I've had. I haven't had a bad day retiring. I remember I was like, I hated Sundays because I really dreaded Monday, and it was that way since, I think, kindergarten. And I retired, right. I said, you know, I've felt the Sunday blues for so long, I wonder if they'll go away. So the first Sunday that I retired, I didn't have the Sunday blues. I had a week ahead of me that belonged to me instead of somebody else.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, it was really a sense of liberation. And, you know, I've been retired now 15 years, and it's been great, you know. I had a plan. I was going to try to retire at 50 if Spanish Children made a lot of money, which it didn't. It's been a print 28 years, but it didn't, like, take in oodles of money. But I did get out at 60, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
You know, my classmate at Manhattan College was James Patterson, the James
Yes.
Patterson. We were in the same English class freshman year, and we were at an alumni thing, and I said, you know, Jim and I together have sold 300 million books worldwide. He sold 299,997,000. Yeah. I've sold the rest.
What, you know, we've known, you know, each other, and indeed still have our wives for decades.
Right.
And when you attend the events, and there must have been hundreds of them in Irish and Irish-American circles, of course, it would be terrific and perhaps expected from once you come through the door that surely, you know, Peter Quinn will have, you know, something to say here, and if Dan Barry and yourself are in the room, then it's expected that both of you, you know,
right.
will come. And sometimes it happens, and it's great. And then there are other times I wonder what the hell that was. You know, Quinn was there and Barry was there, and nobody getting the right time. Does that when you go to events like that, and you have to, you know, if you are going to speak, whether planned or not,
right.
do you look at the crowd and say, boy, all right, I see who's here now, let me gear my, you know, my speech or whatever you might want to call it towards that particular group, because you're good at it.
Right. Well, you know, some speeches, like I used to do a Mussini dinner at NYU, so there was a lot of information I had to get into the speech and try to make it entertaining at the same time. So that you have to write out. Other
yeah.
times, you just called on to speak. I find that really difficult. I much prefer to have a text. First of all, you know, I'm 75 now, so not long ago I gave a toast at a wedding, and I kind of got lost and started to talk about the Franco-Prussian War. So
that must have gone over well.
Well, I said, you know, these people, this is with their third marriage, so I said there are comparisons to the Franco-Prussian War, but I won't go into them. So I usually prefer to read a text and... But, you know, I've cut back on public speaking because it takes a lot of time and effort. And the thing is, the best speeches are the ones that don't look like you prepared them. They kind of feel spontaneous, but making a speech feel spontaneous takes a lot of work.
Now, you, of course, with some Well, unsavory characters, that's not, doesn't include you.
Leave my family out of that.
But you helped get the Irish-American writers and artists, you know, which many would have felt that should have a long history going back considering,
right.
You know. And so you became not only a co-founder, but very much stuck in the middle of what has to be, you know, time-consuming. It has to be,
right.
You know. And I can imagine that a lot of a great number of writers or aspiring writers, you know, would want to, you know, have a few minutes as if, you know, it would be a confessional to hear about, you know, or to get tips from, you know, Peter Quinn.
Yeah.
Is that so, or do you have a strategy not to get bogged down in that?
Well, you know, I thought there was a need for that organization, myself and a couple other people, T.J. English and Danny Cassidy. It was amazing. We had all these Irish-American writers kind of knew each other, but informally and never really talked about. So we founded this organization, but I think one of the real dangers of an organization is a founder who stays too long, you know, and then you become identified with the organization. And my feeling was, when it's up and running, I'll step away, because then it can become what it's supposed to become, and it doesn't become identified with me, and I can step back. Plus, as you just said, it was a lot of work, very distracting. And, you know, there were all sorts of competing agendas, and but, you know, it's really worked out. And this year they have Larry Kerwin as the O'Neill winner. So there have been a number of distinguished, William Kennedy, Brian Dennehy. I mean, you know, they've really given the award to some very distinguished people. And it's now a really thriving organization that has a life of its own. And I'm not really, I mean, I'm still a friend and I go to some of the meetings, but I have no official role, which I'm happy with. And I'm happy to see it get up on its legs and move on its own.
My guest friend is Peter Quinn, of great renown as a, you know, as an author and so many other areas that you might fit into. But I want to ask you about when the impetus for your newest book, which is already, you know, not only a bestseller, but has tremendous critical acclaim. Let me ask you about that book in particular. Would the pandemic have been a good reason for you to write another book, and has, you know, the your storytelling and your, you know, among the best, was that, and now we have the pandemic, and now, yes, of course, this is an ideal time to write. Was this book, was that somewhere, you know, in your own mind, a book that you thought perhaps you could have written or should have written? How did, so you're going to write another book. Why did Cross Bronx, how did you go about that? Or is the book what you had planned to set out to do in the first place?
No, I promised myself I'd never write a memoir. I didn't really want to revisit a lot of stuff, and I was afraid of that I would reveal things or say things about people that were confidential. But I got, at the beginning of the pandemic, I got really sick. I had to be hospitalized twice with what they thought was COVID but wasn't. Fever of unknown origin, they call it. They still don't know what it was. And it had some dramatic side effects. I developed arrhythmia, and I had a subacute stroke from these fevers, and it affected my ability to walk, which I still haven't recovered totally. So I was sitting around, and for some reason, I was working on a novel, but I was having these kind of, I won't say flashbacks, but thought about my childhood. And I started to write them down, and then next thing I know, I was rolling into a memoir. And I think I said earlier, you know, Banished Children took 10 years, and this took 9 months. But I didn't stop. It just came out. And, you know, I significantly shortened it because I didn't want them to be ponderous. And I would write something. I'd say, I'm writing that for me. I don't have to. The audience doesn't have to know this. You know, so I cut a lot, but I was very happy with the results. And, you know, Fordham University Press has republished all my books.
All of them, yeah.
Yeah, and they've done a really good job. And then they bought this book, and, you know, the process was so much faster than other books. And, I've published with Viking Penguin and Overlook and stuff, but
yeah.
I've had a really good experience with Fordham, so I'm very happy. And Fordham's been part of my life since I was a child and part of my family's life. My father was a graduate of Fordham Law School, and my aunt went to the educational. My daughter went to Fordham Law School. My son went to Fordham Lincoln Center. I went to Fordham Graduate School. So I said, you know.
Listen, in hindsight, you know, they're kind of owed to the family. I mean, you know,
right.
Christ's sake. Okay.
I said, you know, I owe the debt, the Jesuits a great debt, and they owe me $300,000 for kids' education.
Yeah. And not even a token in backseas or give back, nothing. All right, well, you know, right, then, they're doing a great job with this. And, again, it's a great book. It's a great read. And for, you know, fans of you and your books for many years, this one has a special category. This is Peter Quinn on writing, on the life of Peter Quinn. So you got that out of your system as well.
Yeah, now I've been working on a novel, but, you know, again, I'm 75, and there aren't the publishing companies are looking for the next great talent there, which is fine with me. I felt like if I didn't publish Banished Children of Eve, I would have been crushed. Yeah. But I wrote, this is now the sixth book, so I don't feel I've been ignored or I haven't had a chance to have my say. I have, and I'm grateful for that. But I'll keep writing. It's just, you know, it's just a compulsion. I enjoy it. Well, I can't say, I wouldn't quite say I enjoy it, but the only thing worse than writing is not writing.
Yeah, and
you know,
how?
I feel this is what I should do, and this is who I am, and I love telling stories, and I love, you know, Bill Kennedy once said to me, he always copied sentences and paragraphs out of books, and he would say, what makes this paragraph different from the others? Why does this stand out? What's the essence of it? And, you know, I do that too. I read a lot of articles. I write for Commonweal. I just wrote an article for Writer's Digest. And that's much less of a heavy lift, an article. You know, 1,200 words of stuff. But that can take me a lot of time, too. You know, I've never had an easy piece of writing. Maybe this Quest Bronx came with a speed, and my other books didn't. But I wouldn't say it was easy. And one thing was, like, digging into my own past, my relationship with my father, and things like that. That wasn't easy at times to write through that.
Yeah. And again, as you had pointed out, you know, you also, when you're writing, you know, effectively as an autobiography, you do have to, I'm sure there are some things that perhaps you wrote, and because, again, of the sensitivities of what may or may not have been, you know, either complimentary or a portion that was very personal, that has to go. But it's a great book. We want to wish you, of course, lots of luck with that. And where can you get the book? Any bookstore?
Amazon. Barnes and Nobles. You can go on the Amazon site and you go with the Fordham University Press. Or you can go to a local penitentiary. I think they carry the book, too.
Great. All right. Well,
all right,
hopefully.
Thanks so much.
Hopefully you can try the others first before you get as far as the penitentiary.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna take 10 years to write the next book, but I hope you invite me back.
Absolutely. Thanks a million. Okay.
All right,
thanks for your time,
care.
Too.
God bless.
Okay,
bye-bye.
God bless. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. A great, a very talented, not only writer, but the best storyteller you could find anywhere, particularly in the, Chronicler of New York City, the book, again, Cross Bronx. It's a writing life. Friends, well, we'll come back after this message.